Welcome to the Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. Around 20 minutes each month of news, scandal and analysis you won't find anywhere else. With me, Naomi Fowler. The Taxcast is available to everyone on www.tackletaxhavens.com. It's also on the Tax Justice Network's website, www.taxjustice.net/taxcast. You can subscribe to our RSS feed, to the Tax Justice Network's YouTube channel, email me on naomi@taxjustice.net, look for us on iTunes, or find us on a radio station near you. Coming up later, democracy for sale, how our politics are heavily reliant on tax haven-friendly donors. But first, a very quick Tax Justice news roundup for this month. The United States is adopting country-by-country reporting for companies from 2016. It means multinationals will have to break down their activities in each country they do business, rather than bundling them all up together. John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network.
Good news. This is a global standard whose time has come, and I'm really proud of the fact that Tax Justice Network, with Richard Murphy, Prem Sikka and myself, took a leading role in pushing this. Richard did all the hard graft, and he must take enormous pleasure from the fact that the United States is now going ahead with this.
Also in the States, forget welfare scroungers, how about corporate welfare scroungers? Large corporations were the main recipients of federal subsidy awards over the last 15 years, according to a new online database. Check out the culprits and the eye-popping figures on the subsidy tracker on www.goodjobsfirst.org. In India, the government there is set to criminalise the hiding of assets for tax purposes. At the moment, it's a civil offence, and if you're found guilty, you face a fine. If that proposal goes ahead, India will be tougher on tax evasion than the UK. We reported on the Taxcast recently that in Britain, a proposal to make criminal prosecution of suspected tax evaders easier by removing the need to prove intent was quietly dropped. Now it's apparently back on the agenda, so we'll be watching that one. Gibraltar's government is suing a Spanish newspaper because it doesn't like the way the paper portrayed it as a tax haven. Now we'll be watching this case with great interest, since Gibraltar scored 79 out of 100 in the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. The little tax haven of Andorra's looking a bit wobbly as we see yet another disproportionately large banking industry hit by money laundering scandals. Andorra's credit rating is now two levels above junk status, and there's talk of another Cyprus. And finally, the City of London has made its position clear on transparency this month. They're saying no to public registers of the real owners of companies. Now that's something the British Prime Minister is supposedly in favour of. So I wonder who's going to win that one. Those are the news headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen at the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. OK, John. We're in a post-HSBC leaks world, and nothing much seems to happen as a result of the exposure of wrongdoing, at least in Britain anyway, so far. But we have some quite big news that HSBC is going to be shutting down, all of a sudden, UK-based customers' offshore accounts in Jersey. So there's a number of questions that raises, obviously. Why now? Why only customers in the UK with Jersey accounts? Is it only HSBC that's facing risks in that area? And why is only Jersey now seen as a risk jurisdiction? I mean, what are they doing? What's going on here?
Right. Well, first of all, Jersey is a high-risk jurisdiction. Many, many big banks have been running offshore client accounts through Jersey for a long, long time. And the regulators in Jersey are notoriously lax. So Jersey is a high-risk jurisdiction, but no higher risk than, say, Luxembourg, certainly Switzerland, or the Cayman Islands. So why are HSBC only doing this in Jersey? Now questions are being asked, well, what's happened in Jersey? And what is HSBC doing to clean up its act? But why is it just HSBC? I mean, presumably Bank of America, Citibank, Bank of India, they have a branch in Jersey. no Indian communities in Jersey. So what is the Bank of India doing in Jersey? RBS, a huge offshore wealth management facility in Jersey. Barclays Bank, huge wealth management facility in Jersey. Why is it just HSBC? And why is it just Jersey? I mean, these are important questions. But it is absolutely clear to me at this stage that HSBC is going through something of a window dressing exercise. I don't think they're doing a full and proper, a rigorous analysis right the way across all of their offshore operations in all of the many, many tax havens around the world where they operate. If they're going to convince us that they're doing it, they must do it in every jurisdiction. And getting back to Jersey, of course, the Jersey authorities, as they always do, say that Jersey's well regulated, it's transparent and it's cooperative. And we all know that that's nonsense. Jersey's score on the Financial Secrecy Index remains a wretchedly poor 75 out of 100, which is extremely poor. And Jersey's got to demonstrate that they are trying harder. The interesting thing about Jersey is how aggressive they are in saying we're clean and we're cooperative and we're transparent. And the most aggressive of all is the head of Jersey Finance, a man called Jeffrey Cook, who's always out there in the newspapers saying that the critics of Jersey have got it wrong. The interesting thing about Jeffrey Cook is, guess what? He used to be wealth management at which bank? HSBC. So he was right there at the heart of HSBC when all of these problems were cooking up in the 80s and the 90s.
Right, and it's a small world, isn't it, in the finance sector? And so we've got a de-risk alert, but only a partial one. And
yeah, and I think HSBC are really feeling the heat, and we have the same old thing yet again, disappointingly, that no one in Britain is being held to account, no one is being investigated, no one is being sent to prison, and yet we know this was a criminal bank.
Moving on then, this month the Tax Justice Network has launched a new report on the demise of the corporate income tax. Now, you think that we're in the last few years possibly before big business manages to abolish it completely?
I'm not alone in thinking that the logical next step, if the OECD succeeds in sorting out the corporate income tax and multinational companies find themselves actually having to pay tax in a few countries, they're going to hate it, if nothing else, because their directors will find that paying tax leads to a fall in their stock option values, because the share prices will come down. So they're going to resist. And the way they're resisting it, and we're already picking up on a clear pattern of resistance. And the resistance comes in the form of arguments being put through newspaper comment pieces and here on the radio more and more, and think tanks coming out with learned pieces, by and large think tanks funded by corporations, saying that the corporate income tax is a bad tax. It's an inefficient tax. It causes distortions. It doesn't raise enough money. Let's abolish it. And that sounds extremely attractive till you think about it for 3 seconds and recognise the corporate income tax is one of the most important taxes we have. It's one of the last remaining taxes on capital. All the other taxes have been shifted onto labour or onto consumers. But this is a tax on capital. It can raise enormous sums of money. For example, since the financial crisis, just in the OECD countries, the corporate income tax has yielded over $7 trillion of revenue, and that's an awful lot of health expenditure or education expenditure. So it's an important tax, but more important than just the revenue raising side, it's a block to really wealthy people who, if they realize that corporate income tax has been abolished, they'll simply transfer all of their wealth, all of their income, all of their assets into companies, and they'll have the perfect way of avoiding ever paying tax again. And this is already happening anyway, but we need the corporate income tax. If we don't retain the corporate income tax, inequality will continue to rise faster and faster and faster across the entire world because we can no longer tax capital. So it's really important that we do this. And it's also a really important tool for rebalancing the economy. I mean, one of the most extraordinary things that's come out of the economic recession of the last 5 years has been the extent to which big multinational companies simply don't know what to do with their cash reserves. They're holding record levels of cash reserves, wasting them. And the best thing to do, frankly, would be to tax those reserves and reallocate that money through public expenditure into roads and into schools and into hospitals and into research and development and to training the workforce, because that would boost demand in the economy.
Not to mention see an end to austerity.
It would see an end to austerity. It would certainly get economies going again. And it's time for the world to wake up, recognise the huge amount of lobbying that's happening. And if we don't preserve the corporate income tax, it's very likely that it'll go within the next decade. And why do I say that within the next decade? We've seen a very steady downward trend in the corporate income tax rate. We've seen huge amounts of exemptions and loopholes being exploited. So many companies are already paying effective tax rates in single figures. If one country, like the United States, goes, then all others will follow. And that would be a disaster for countries across the world.
Anyway, let's talk about Australia, because the government there is quite interestingly painting their country as a kind of a high-risk kidnap location for the wealthy in the style of Colombia or Venezuela, who really have experienced very real and genuine problems in that area. What's happening there is that we've got companies with a turnover of over 100 million Australian dollars. The government's going to make them exempt from publishing their tax information. That was a law that was passed by the previous government. And this new government, no doubt, has quite a number of donors in that business community. So kidnap, big risk.
I actually thought what had happened was that someone had put out a press release ahead of April Fool's Day and the whole joke had gone wrong. But apparently this is no joke. I took the trouble of checking out on the Australian crime statistics to see how many company directors or their family had been kidnapped and held to ransom in the last few years. And the statistics are surprisingly low. In fact, they're none whatsoever. So what is this story? This is a nonsense. Now, this applies to about 700 or so companies in Australia. So it's not an insubstantial number of companies. But of all the reasons for giving, for being secretive and not going ahead with a transparency measure, this has got to be the most pathetic I've ever heard. It's bad enough hearing these silly arguments from lawyers in Latin America who say, oh goodness, if our clients had information revealed under automatic information exchange deals, they might become liable to kidnapping. As if the people in Latin America don't know exactly who the rich people are. They see them driving their Mercedes-Benz on the street every day.
And in their gated communities.
And in their gated communities. Everyone knows in Latin America who's rich and who isn't. But apparently sharing tax information or making tax information transparent and publicly available in the case of very large companies exposes these poor, wretched company directors to a too high a level of risk. This is nonsense, and shame on the Australian Prime Minister for peddling such nonsense.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. Politicians talk a lot about fixing criminality in the finance sector, about tackling corporate tax abuse and bringing transparency to secrecy jurisdictions. They make a few tweaks here and there, but nothing major ever really seems to get done. This month, the TaxCast takes a look at political donations and democracy for sale.
This is something that's got to turn around, or else we won't have an America the way we knew America to be. We'll have an America totally controlled by corporations.
These protesters outside the US Supreme Court are upset about the Citizens United ruling a few years ago. It removed existing caps on how much money could be donated to political campaigns. So now billionaires, millionaires and big corporations, foreign or domestic, can make unlimited contributions. Here's Senator Elizabeth Warren addressing members of the Congress on the subject.
We were not sent here to run this country for a handful of wealthy individuals and powerful corporations. We were sent here to do our best to make this country work for all our people. The Supreme Court overturned a century of precedent and making it far easier for millionaires, billionaires, and big corporations to flood our elections with massive amounts of money. The Supreme Court is helping them buy elections. The five conservative justices currently sitting on the Supreme Court are in the top 10 most pro-corporate justices in more than half a century. We are here today to try to reverse the damage inflicted on our country by these decisions.
It's not as if things weren't already bad enough in the United States before the Citizens United ruling, and nowhere is the influence of big business and wealthy individuals more apparent than in the area of tax and finance policy making.
Well, we can't get any really good things done. The lawmakers that go to Washington don't do what their constituents send them to do because they have to answer to the people who funded their campaign. And the people who funded their campaign are wealthy individuals and mostly corporations.
Rebecca Wilkins of the Financial Accountability and Corporate Transparency Coalition.
We joke that the members of Congress ought to have to wear a NASCAR type uniform, which is the uniform that race drivers wear, that has the corporate logo of all the people that fund them. If they wore those in the halls of Congress, it would be a much more transparent what they're actually doing. There's a lot of lobbyists, and unfortunately, they have made great inroads on both sides of the aisle. So it's not like one party is much better than the other. It's really frustrating because when something like the HSBC Swiss leaks breaks, or there's a big story about how Apple or Google or somebody's not paying tax, politicians from both parties will say the right things. They'll say how outrageous it is and how we need to fix the system. But when they actually get down to getting something done, nothing happens. I think they don't want to do anything. And as long as that's the way the system works, it'll be very hard to get really good tax policy passed.
That's because these days the United States is apparently no longer a democracy, but an oligarchy. It's not me saying that, it's the conclusion of two professors from Princeton University and Northwestern University in the States. They measured political influence on nearly 1,800 policy issues, and they concluded that compared to the wealthy, average US citizens have, quote, a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy. Here's Senator Elizabeth Warren on what's happened to campaign contributions in the states since the last presidential election.
In 2012, about 3.7 million typical Americans gave modest donations, $200 or less, to President Obama and Mitt Romney. Now, these donations altogether added up to about $313 million. In that same election, 32 Americans gave monster donations. 32 people spent slightly more on the 2012 elections than 3.7 million typical Americans who sent in modest dollar donations to their preferred presidential candidate. When 32 people can outspend 3.7 million citizens, our democracy is in real danger.
And if we leave it all to billionaires, millionaires, and corporations, our democracies will be funded by people who don't appear to believe in transparency, the public interest, and very often in paying taxes. That doesn't just matter for US citizens, it matters for the rest of the world. Don't forget that the United States is currently ranked number 6 in the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. Tax Haven USA is alive and well. Delaware is probably one of the world's largest secrecy jurisdictions. And, of course, this is by no means just a problem for the US political system.
Mr. Speaker, an hour ago we learned that linked to the HSBC tax avoidance scandal are seven Tory donors, including a former treasurer of the Tory party, who between them have given nearly £5 million to the Conservative Party. How can the Prime Minister explain the revolving door between Tory party HQ and the Swiss branch of HSBC?
I saw this list just before coming to Prime Minister's questions, and one of the people named is the Labour donor Lord Paul, who funded Gordon Brown's election campaign.
British politicians there throwing around accusations in Parliament recently, but none of the mainstream parties can really claim the moral high ground, and they tend to stay off this territory. And remember that Britain's network of tax havens is the largest in the world by far. The Bureau for Investigative Journalism's Nick Mathiason has broken various stories on money in British politics, particularly the relationship between the current government and the Square Mile, the City of London's finance sector.
Well, I think the biggest influence that the Conservative Party has is the City of London and hedge funds and private equity. And the work we did at the Bureau of Investigative Journalism initially tracked the amount of money going to the Conservative Party from the Square Mile. And we could see that in 2005, David Cameron received 25% of his funding from the City of London, and that by 2010, just before the election, that funding from the City had gone up to over 50%, which effectively was a city takeover of the Conservative Party. And they did that mainly, I think, to influence policy outcomes. We have seen situations in which policy has been favourable to the Square Mile.
Such as?
I think the most obvious example is the way that the government has reacted to Europe's attempt to introduce a financial transaction tax, which would tax every single trade on foreign exchange and derivatives in a very, very small way. And that is something that the City of London has really reacted against. And from day one, David Cameron has ruled that out. And we do know that Conservative Party donors have been very strong in opposing that and have said that they've had assurances from party leaders that this will never happen. And so I think that's a really obvious example. There are others.
Indeed there are. The 2015 finance bill is set to exempt private equity firms from new anti-tax avoidance legislation. Hedge funds have enjoyed an effective £145 million tax cut. British banks and tax havens continue to enjoy what looks like protection from the government, almost regardless of what they get up to. And when you take a look at who's bankrolling politics and even who's going to which fundraising parties, none of this should come as a surprise. Nick Mathiason.
We were fortunate enough to receive two leaks of table plans of Conservative Party fundraising events. One was the summer party and the other one was the black and white ball. They're major events, and both events were really dominated by people from the City of London, hedge funds, private equity tycoons, investment asset managers. They were the biggest component within the guest list by quite a long way.
Now, these parties are normally secret and no press are allowed. On these occasions, Conservative Party supporters with a combined wealth of more than $16 billion paid $17,000 or $18,000 a table to dine with government ministers. Melanie Newman of the Bureau of Investigative Journalists.
What came out, the analysis of the summer party, was that there, a lot of the guests, they were an international elite and there was a disproportionate number of Russians there. But you've got to ask, these are people with limited ties to the UK. They're donating huge sums. What are they getting in return, and what is the influence on policy? And that was at a point where relationships with Russia were very sensitive and there were foreign policy decisions being made.
We no longer live in a democracy. We live in a political tax haven industrial complex.
This is Donica McCarthy.
I was deputy chair of one of Britain's major political parties, the third party, the Liberal Democrats. And in my experience there, I was very unhappy with how funding was affecting the party's honesty and integrity. And so I decided to try and reform it. And having spent 12 years trying to clean up the party, I decided that it was probably time for me to go. And I left.
After he left, Donica started investigating all of the political parties, and he's now written a book called Prostitute State, How Britain's Democracy Has Been Bought.
A lot of the party funding in the three major parties in Britain over the last decade have been funded by people associated with tax havens. I suddenly realised the link between the political direction of Britain and its protection of its international network of tax havens. And is it any wonder then that there isn't a culture in our legislature to seriously tackle the tax haven scandal?
Right, and it's not only that donors are so strongly linked to tax havens that worries you, it's also about the lack of transparency. So, I mean, things like anonymous contributions over a certain level and donations to political parties from overseas, they're against the rules, aren't they?
Absolutely, and one of the extraordinary stories, the story about Michael Brown, who is a convicted fraudster and who donated £2 million. When the scandal broke and the Electoral Commission looked at the donations, it was very clear that the donations came from a private equity account in Switzerland. The police were very clear that the money was channeled through a front company in the United Kingdom that was set up specifically for the purpose. And indeed, there was evidence to prove this, written evidence. And still, the Electoral Commission didn't take any action against those involved in the Liberal Democrats. So basically, there seems to be regulations, but they don't seem to be observed or enforced by the authorities. A company in Switzerland can wire to a front company that you set up in the United Kingdom, Nofshef Company, and then you can use that company to donate to political parties.
Right, and the Electoral Commission ruled that those donations made that way were legal, and that was a controversial decision. And you say the leadership of the Liberal Democrat Party blocked your many efforts to make donations more transparent, and you fought a lot in particular with two of the party treasurers at the time.
I thought my battles with these two gentlemen were just happened to be, you know, personality clashes, but Clement Jones was a lobbyist for the Cayman Islands, one of the world's most notorious tax havens. And Lord Razzle runs a tax advice organisation based in the tax haven of the Channel Islands.
And neither of them has been found to have broken the rules, but it raises questions, certainly, as does the fact that one of the party's major donors at the time of the last general election was a private healthcare company with strong links to the British Virgin Islands. A number of controversial National Health Service reforms were pushed through Parliament after that election, which would have been impossible without the help of your former party. And another huge area of concern is the House of Lords. So tell me why.
Unlike most other countries in the world, Britain has an upper house that's not elected, but rather is appointed by the party leaders, which is, of course, ripe for corruption. And basically, in all three major parties, the link between a person who gives a large amount of money to the party, i.e. a party donor, and those who get seats in our upper chamber is quite a direct link. It's just basically a direct form of corruption that's been in existence in Britain for over a century. In other countries such as America, you buy the senator or you buy the House Democrat or a Republican by funding their election campaigns. Here you make a donation, you get a seat in the Lords itself, and that means you have direct influence over legislation. The upper house in Britain, 40% of the amendments that they pass become law. Nearly a majority of the membership of the Budget Committee of the upper house in Britain's legislature are made up of directors of banks and private equity corporations.
So in Britain, we definitely need a reformed upper house of elected representatives rather than appointed ones. And what do we do about the donors? Nick Mathiasen again.
Personally, I think the only way to ensure that vested interests don't exert undue influence over party politics is to take big money out of politics and cap the level of donations and have more taxpayers' money funding political parties. I think that's really the only way that you can ensure that cash doesn't influence policy outcomes. The main political parties run collectively on around about £70 million a year in the scheme of things. It's not that much.
Rebecca Wilkins again.
We really need public financing of elections.
Obviously, the idea of public finance for politicians is a very unpopular idea because people don't want that to cost them. But actually, it's costing them a lot more not to do it that way, isn't it?
That's exactly right. They're paying a lot more than they would to finance the elections. I mean, our estimates in the US are that we lose about $150 billion a year through tax haven abuse. And that means that ordinary Americans make it the difference, either through increased taxes or reduced services or more government debt. And so they are paying the difference, and financing the campaigns would cost a lot less money than that.
The question is, what kind of world do we want to live in? Now, billions in public spending are at risk as big business pushes to abolish corporate tax completely, despite their rising profits. For more information on Donica McCarthy's book, The Prostitute State, go to www.theprostitutestate.co.uk. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. We'll be back next month.